Our topic today is, I've never taught this topic before. It's actually quite interesting. I don't know who thought of it. How to draw power through a spiritual teacher. So I'm as interested in you as you are to sort of hear. And I would like to start, I know some of you are here just because I've been away and I'm not. So, but if you're interested in the topic particularly, I'd really like to hear what you might be thinking or what you might be hoping to learn. Because we're all in this together today, even more than usual. So I'll start with you, Sai Ganesh.
I saw the topic earlier, but I actually thought about it only today morning before I came to the class. And I was thinking about how I relate to the gurus and how I draw their presence in my life. And I was interested in what you had to say in terms of anything practical that we might keep in mind. Because I felt that's exactly what we're trying to do all the time. Mm-hmm. Whether, even though our gurus might not be physically present, we are always trying to draw their power into our lives in some fashion or the other. And so I was interested in the topic only when I thought about it that way today morning. Mm-hmm. So.
Very good. Tom?
I was thinking about, I saw it a week or so ago, and I thought, it's a class you've never taught before.
Yeah.
And
I think we have new people making up the calendars.
You just came back from the Holy Land, so you're going to be in a really good space. And I was more thinking about it individually, directly to Swami, mm-hmm. and how I could, gain some, get better at that and improve on that. And you're the one here, so.
Happy to help. Atmajyoti, you too just got back from pilgrimage. Yeah.
Well, I too was thinking that it would be a way to understand more clearly how you created your relationship with the gurus, and particularly with Swami. But I also wanted to feel the vibration of being a part of your teachings, you being my teacher, mm-hmm. and strengthening that, because I find that helps in my practice, mm-hmm. Because the more I relate to how you're feeling about how you felt about Swami, who felt about his guru, it just kind of permeates then through me and just seems to make my life go better.
I think practical examples make all the difference. Otherwise, we can get pretty much lost in the woods of our own ideas of things. I agree with you in that respect. Larry?
Well, to be honest, I'm here because you're teaching a Saturday morning class, and I'm interested in pretty much any spiritual topic mm-hmm. that you're talking about. However, I've experienced the guru's power in my life in ways that, even though I believed in it before, to experience it manifested is a remarkable thing. And anything more that I can learn, to become more attuned or to make that even more present would just be great.
Very good. Vinny, do you want to be a class participant this time? Yeah.
I was thinking about the aspect of giving aspect of this teaching, because I'm imagining that's a component that would allow us to also receive that power right. from our spiritual teachers. And just wondering, what are the best ways that we can give to our gurus and our spiritual teachers in a way that will also help us continue that flow of receiving as well? So just some practical ways right. of how best to give ourselves so that we can also receive.
Very good question. Very good comments. Larry, did you have anything else to say? Okay, Sneha?
There's a long story behind it, but to keep it short, I find myself in the same place, asking the same questions I did 10 years ago, uh-huh. but 10 years have passed, and now I'm on the spiritual path. I'm part of Ananda, and I find myself making progress and then stepping back, making progress, and then finding myself...
Are you stepping back or falling back?
Falling back.
Okay.
It's not... Well, it's...
I mean, the language, I'm very precise, but they do mean different things.
Yes, they do.
Falling back is that you're trying to go forward and then you can't make it. Stepping back is that you yourself hesitate. So,
well, the hesitation is not... okay, so...
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
And I find myself wanting to know how I can keep increasing and making longer strides towards the masters and feeling their presence all of the time.
Right.
And so, but despite that, I still find myself in the same position I was 10 years ago. So I feel like my inner landscape seems to be not very different from 10 years ago. So how can I keep...
But your outer landscape has changed radically.
Yes, okay. It has.
So to be fair to yourself...
Yes.
Much has happened, even if you may feel the same in the midst of it. Somewhere your magnetism is working.
Right.
Because it has brought you things you didn't have before, just to just cheer you up a little.
Yeah.
That's all I was trying to do. Okay.
So that's my understanding is how can I keep attuning myself. It's not just during Sunday service and Thursdays and Tuesdays and Saturday classes, but all of the time, how do I think of Master? How do I dedicate every moment of my day to the masters. So
very good, very important. Anya?
I wouldn't really, I'm here to, because I always get inspired whenever I go to this particular place. This is the main reason why I'm here. And also I would really like Sneha just said, to live every moment and know what is the truth and what is the illusion, and I just seem not to be very good at this, and it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. So whatever tool I might get anywhere, anytime, I'm going to go for it.
That's a good attitude.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Deepika?
It's interesting because when I still looked at this class, I haven't been to your class for a while because of kids. The first thing that came to my mind is, I want to be like you. And the first thing that came to my mind, I want to be calmer like you. I want to be loving, caring like you. That was my biggest, that's the challenge I have been going through. It's like same story like Sneha. I have been following Ananda. I have been blessed with their guru's presence in my life, but same thing, my desires hold me back, my ignorance holds me back, and then I want to move forward, but then I get stuck in this world, like, I don't know, like, it's just, but when I looked at this class, I said, okay, gurus are willing to help me, now I need to move forward, and I don't know how you stay calm. I don't know how you... because I do listen to Swamiji's videos I watch, and it's not easy to move away from your desires, and I want to live for divine. I want to develop that desire to be with him, to be one with him.
Yes, very good. Divine law is that every desire ultimately has to be fulfilled. Seriously. So even if you have the desire for divine things, your success is guaranteed. When, it's a different question, but but time is an illusion. So, but it's very important. The most important thing is the aspiration. Seriously. Very, very seriously, I mean that. We'll talk about it. Ellen.
So I was thinking about this topic, and it is very interesting because I've never heard you talk on this before. And I was thinking about the times in my life when I particularly received, I call it inspiration rather than power, but I think they're quite similar. And I was thinking about the times when
I've... Hold the microphone just a little closer to you so they'll go... Okay, go ahead.
I was thinking about the times when I've received inspiration where I've almost been knocked down by it, and then the subtler times when I'm living my everyday life and things just come in to help me go through. So I just like for that to expand more because I think I feel like it's in motion, and I just want to allow it and let it expand more.
More of it, more and better. That's how Gyanamata said it, more and better.
More and better is good.
Okay.
the topic jumped off the page when I saw it in your home, so that's good too. More and better. I want to be of service, and it's not helpful if it's just me. Mm-hmm. So any way that I can deepen my connection and my ability to be a channel is what I'm trying to understand.
That's perfect. Okay. Wow. All right. There's just so many levels to this topic. We'll just kind of randomly shoot out and see where we end up, because there's a million different things that could be said. I'm going to start just in relation to the trip I just took, which was to Israel for the first time. The first time we went to India, I went to India, I was also was leading a pilgrimage. This one I wasn't leading it, I was just on it. And it was, we visited the sites where we went to Lahiri's house in Varanasi. We went to where Sri Yukteswar was buried in Puri. At that time, one of Lahiri's relatives was still living, and so you could go into the house. They didn't give you free access like they do at Master's childhood home, but at least we went in. Now you just stand in at the outside doorway, which is still a lot, but we were able to go in. So we went to Lahiri's house in Varanasi. We went to where Sri Yukteswar was buried in Puri. We went to Four Garpar Road, where Master had his childhood home. We went, I'm not quite sure where we went to Nepal, but we went, maybe we didn't go all the way into the high Himalayas, but maybe we did. Maybe we went all the way to Nepal. Somehow I believe I saw the high Himalayas. Yes, we did. That's right. And we took an airplane ride over the high Himalayas. So there was a strong feeling of Babaji also in that trip. None of Yogananda, of course, really some of his strongest shrines are in America, in Los Angeles. But for the other masters, there was nothing in the U.S. Now we have a few specific relics that have been given to us that at the Shrine of the Masters. But it was the first time I was able to be in the atmosphere that had been actually affected by that incarnation. And It was an extraordinary trip in every respect, never having been to India, never having been on pilgrimage, leading a pilgrimage for the first time I'd ever been on one. And just everything was new. And I didn't have any idea how to gauge its effect. Over the course of 20 years, we led that trip about, I think it was 12 times, and got very familiar with lots of aspects, and I did other pilgrimages too, not leading, but to Los Angeles, to Italy. So I understood the power of being in the vibrations of the masters more later. But when I came back and for the first time led the Festival of Light, where we held the candle and held it in front of the master's pictures, which I had already been doing for just a short time prior to that, not much prior to that, I was really impressed by offering that candle to each of the different gurus, how different my relationship was. And that I just standing in front of Sri Yukteswar, all of a sudden it was more than a name to me and a photograph. There was some living transference of energy that had not been present before. Was it some kind of automatic effect from having bathed in the vibrations? Was it the effect of concentrating myself in a way that I'd never had the opportunity to do before, just because the nature of pilgrimage, it leaves you very free to experience in ways that you don't otherwise. As much as anything, because you just don't. We're too busy, we're too distracted, which is one of the benefits of pilgrimage inherently anyway. So I've just returned from this trip to Israel, where I went to the places where Jesus lived, which of course is, well, Jesus spent 18 years of his life in India, and there's different places in India where they claim he was. He was at the Jagannath Temple, we know for sure, in Puri. but I'd never gone to the Jagannath temple thinking Jesus. So whether I picked it up there or not, I don't know. And just not to belabor the point, because I'll talk about it in a few days more. But the trip in Israel was not exactly as I expected it. I had a much more impersonal, uplifted experience. It didn't end up sort of having the word Jesus on it as much, except that I felt tremendous inspiration in quite a few places. But just now, which is the first public thing I've done since I came home, when I said Jesus Christ, there was a different quality in my heart about it. And I was very conscious of it. I mean, it just goes by in a second. But all of a sudden, I realized that there is some actual transference, that from meditating in Galilee and being in Jerusalem, now there's something there that wasn't there before. I knew something happened, but I didn't realize it would be tied like that. I'm saying this not just to emphasize pilgrimage, which is a great thing if you have the time and money and can do it, but not everybody has the time and money, so we don't want to say that this is required. But to say that there is a real progression in our relationships that seems to have its own, I'm going to call it a karmic schedule, that has a karmic schedule, that our part is simply to persevere, to make best use of every opportunity that's given to us, and that's our role. Now, we have to make best use of it, not in this paranoid, nothing I do is adequate, I always fail, self-absorbed, self-critical, that undermines our best efforts. But even if we're really terrible at our part of it, even that little tiny bit is still the best we have to offer. And there's more can't be asked of us than that. So in the Christian Bible, St. John says, as many as received him, referring to Jesus, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. And when Swamiji wrote the Festival of Light, which is a ritual that he wrote for a long time to come, it does not have a short expiration date. That's going to be with us for a very long time. And he wrote it in a state of great inspiration about 30 some years ago, but it was a very critical moment in Ananda's history. And he was trying to create for us an instrument of attunement, something that we could regularly participate in that would influence us on a continuous and ever deeper level. I know some people complain about repeating ritual. They tell me they get bored, they get tired of listening to it, they wish the music would change. Other people have different attitudes, but people have many different attitudes toward ritual. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a peer, and I was just telling him how much I absolutely love the fact that I get to stand close to the altar a lot of the time. That's how I define my life, is that I tend to be able to stand close to the altar, and that how I love the festival. And my dear friend said, oh, sort of like that. You know, just like, oh, that's nice, because that works for you, doesn't it? And I was realizing that he's not having the same experience that I'm having. But the point was that Swamiji, every phrase of that was really divinely inspired to Swami's full capabilities, which are considerable. And he chose very selectively from pre-existing spiritual principles. An Israeli came to our Sunday service once, and there's a phrase in there that says, your chosen people have always been those of every race and nation who with deep love chose thee. Being the chosen people is an extremely important principle in Judaism. And he was livid just livid because he felt the whole festival was an insult to the Jewish people. And I listened to him for a minute or two, and then I said, oh, I said, I understand what you're saying, but you don't realize how many insults there are to Hindus and Christians also in there. You just don't know enough to know that. And he looked totally startled, but it did disarm him. I said, it's not really insults, but this is a change. You know, things are changing. This is from Kali Yuga to Dwapara. So many cherished traditions need to be reconsidered, and we need to come at this all in a brand new way. He at least got off of his thinking that we were anti-Semitic, which was about the craziest thing he could have thought. But he's right. We are renewing old traditions. All of that is to say that of all the things Swami could have chosen, as you know, to all those who received him, is in the Festival of Light. And when I'm leading that or listening to it, but often especially when I'm reading it because it's also the words are visual, I very often want to stop and say to people, do you really understand what this means? Because that word, receptivity, as many as received him, it's as simple as that. And he says he gave them the full power to become self-realized. And, you know, everything that everybody's wanting in between is to become a son of God, which is Jesus' symbolic way of speaking about becoming a self-realized master. That was how he spoke of it, given the time and place in which he was teaching. And the only qualification John gave was that you receive that power. So we have this picture in our minds that we really have to understand. And this is I think, one of the most important principles on the spiritual path, which is that we are very, very, very busy much of the time evaluating and usually negatively evaluating and judging ourselves and the people around us. We are often drawing comparisons between other people's accomplishment, good karma, freedom, whatever it might be, and our own, by comparison, lack of it. We're just busy, 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 busy all the time, analyzing, evaluating, and measuring, and then measuring and coming up short. I mean, if we really think about how much time and energy we spend doing that, it's not a pretty thing to contemplate. And then what we tend to do is that we imagine that in all those negative evaluations, we are in fact being inspired by God to actually finally see things in the proper perspective. And that thought alone blocks our receptivity more than anything. More than sadness, more than restlessness of mind, more than lack of discipline, more than sensuality, more than gross appetites, is the single thought that God is judging us and finding us inadequate. Because once we feel judged, I mean, where is the open heart? I mean, think about the friendships in your life and our relationship with God. I'll reverse it. Swamiji says, and this is very interesting to contemplate, he put it this way very simply, everything on the material plane is a symbol of more subtle realities. And he spoke even of the sun is a symbol of the spiritual eye. And the way the moon is only illuminated because it reflects the sun is a symbol of the individual soul, the Christ presence within, which is not self-illuminating, but can yet reflect the power that comes from the source. And we think of the sun as being just gigantic and huge and the source of everything, but it's only symbolic of the spiritual eye at this point in the medulla, which is where the ego is based, and the medulla's tendency to claim its own light. If the moon had an ego and claimed that it itself was shining, we would laugh at it because scientifically we know that it's merely a reflection. The ego claims to be the source of the light that shines through it. And spiritual scientists laugh, but worldly people don't know the difference. I mean, primitive peoples seeing the moon shining, it would never cross their mind that the moon was a reflection of the sun. It so clearly had its own light. And spiritually ignorant people think that the ego has its own light, but it doesn't. So we imagine that our relationship with God and Guru and our relationship with our spiritual teacher, teachers, however we want to think about it, those who inspire us spiritually, is somehow completely other than the rest of our lives, but it's not. Rather, the rest of our lives are how we practice and see things up close that then teach us about, they're symbolic. You know, if we organize ourselves properly in all the small things, we suddenly find that we're organized properly in the large ones as well. And when we pretend to be organized in the large ones, but are consciously and deliberately inappropriate in the small ones, I don't mean ignorantly inappropriate, because we are. That's just the way it is. But if we think it doesn't matter, I had a friend early on, you know, there are lots of principles. The way Jesus put it was, cast not your pearls before swine, which is to say, don't give that of great value to those who won't be able to appreciate it. And that principle has been followed in every religious tradition, saying there's an appropriate time to tell people certain things, because otherwise they'll misuse them. When I was very early learning about the spiritual path and learning about how everything in this world was an illusion and so on, one of my acquaintances at that time was actually a thief, which he justified on the basis that it's all an illusion anyway. He was a perfect example of someone who should not be exposed to that kind of teaching, because he didn't have the moral purity to use it correctly. But when we're thinking about so grand a statement as many as received him, to them gave he the power, rather than feeling bewildered by that, just think about any relationship that you have in your life. And think about how much the flow of that relationship and how much you are able to give to others and how much others are able to give to you is based entirely on your openness to one another. I mean, we have relationships all the time where we're very, very guarded. I'm in a position, have been in a position of counseling people a great deal for many years, meaning doing a great deal of counseling for many years. And sometimes I either know intuitively or I've simply been informed from another source about realities that people don't want to tell me about. But if people don't want to tell me about it, there's nothing I can do. If a person is going to present themselves to me in a certain way, I simply have to relate to the person that's presented to me. And sometimes I have knowledge and I know, and then I can at least try to work around that, or I sense it. But sometimes I just don't know. Somebody just presents something to me in a certain way, and well, there it is, and so I respond accordingly. And all my advice is ridiculous and none of it is effective, because I was presented a reality that just isn't there. And the whole relationship is defined by what? By receptivity. And by what is receptivity? Receptivity is the willingness to be present and the willingness to deal with what is. First and above all, and what is the blocking to that openness. And this is again what we understand from this phrase, which is why it's so important. It's never on the side of the masters. And that's something that we have to meditate on and contemplate over and over and over and over again. Think of the story in The Path where Swamiji talks about this certain man. He was in show business. I talked about the story because it's in conversations and it came up in a class, and I suggested a certain name or two as to what famous singer of the time it was, but I ended up being completely bewildered as to who the story is about. But he was a Hollywood character. And Hollywood characters are They don't have a great reputation for always being authentic. They're used to presenting themselves in certain ways. So this was a well-known performer of some kind, I believe a singer. And he really liked to come and see Master. And when he was with Master, he put forward this great sincere interest in the teachings. Now, Master himself did not spend the time teaching people how to meditate. He didn't even give Kriya initiations anymore by the time Swami was there. He had Swamiji and others do that for him. It just was a level of individual involvement that he needed to put his attention elsewhere. So when this man expressed interest in learning the techniques and practicing Kriya, Master directed him to Swamiji. And in front of Master, he was all sincerity, and he would make appointments, and he was going to meet Swami, he was going to learn these things. But when the time came, he never showed up. And Swamiji became very impatient with him. And he said, he's not sincere. He's just with Master for the glamour of being with Master. But when he has to sincerely put himself behind it, he doesn't follow through. So Swamiji just didn't have any use for him anymore. He just felt, I'm wasting my time with this man. And the man didn't come to see Swamiji, but Swamiji often served tea or served the meals. Master had Swamiji with him. So Swamiji said to Master, you know, he's not sincere. He doesn't follow through. Well, Swami felt obligated to tell Master. Master said, well, we'll have fun with him today. And Swami's natural thought was that something stern would happen. But instead, Master was even more loving to him, even more kind, even more welcoming and magnetic. And Swami was just cold and rude and just felt that he needed to be appropriate in his response. And afterwards, Master said, my, you were cold to him, weren't you? And perhaps that's when Swami explained, well, he's not sincere. And Master just said so simply, how would any of you have fared if I had treated you so coldly? Which is just the actual honest question. And what we have to understand and being able to receive the power of the masters to a certain extent, I want to put it this way, to the extent to which we're capable, because to say that we have to understand Master is just crazy, because we simply can't. We don't have the spiritual ability ourselves to know what we're looking at. But we have to understand certain realities about the Master that our own limitations keep us from understanding. And it's in understanding those we also overcome our own limitations, which is the Master has absolutely nothing at stake. It's a very interesting thing to try to understand. We have so much at stake all the time, all of us, because we're in complicated karmic positions and we have some very interwoven interplay of karma, of insecurities, of past unresolved hurts, of hopes and aspirations that we're afraid might not be fulfilled, of attachment to our children, of desires for love and success. I mean, make a huge long list of it. And all of that is a whole complicated system of karmic knots, you might say. And gradually all of that has to be smoothed out. You know, all of these shawls that you find often have fringes at the end. And for a while, the silk shawls that we wear on Sunday when we're dressed as light bearers, for a number of years, instead of hemming the edges, I fringed the edges. I kept about an inch of silk fringe because I just liked the way it looked. And then I would wash the thing, and all that fringe, those tiny little silk threads, would just snarl up. I actually got a toothbrush, and I'm very meticulous, and I would spray it with water, and I learned to brush it with a toothbrush to smooth it all out and iron it. But it was a very complicated system of knots, and sometimes these things get really knotted up, and you know, the girl will just sit there in a class and untie the knots on her. Well, that hardly begins to describe, you know, this thread goes over here in attachment to this one and then gets snarled up with that one, and then this one comes in and does something unkind, so this one comes over and wants to have a revenge against that one, but then this one over here feels bad because you know you shouldn't be angry, and you can see. And thinking about all our incarnations, that's where we're standing, isn't it? And every little piece of that, and there's many ways to do it. The toothbrush turned out to be a really efficient way to just smooth them all out at the same time. I didn't have to relate to every knot. And that's Kriya, if you want to think about it like that, the toothbrush method. But sometimes you have to just get in there. And so we always have a lot at stake, because with us, we have a lot of knots still. But of course, the process of spiritual freedom is that all those knots are smooth and everything is free. So we can only use our imagination. Just imagine a state of consciousness in which there's no ripple. There's no, as Master calls it, thwarting cross currents of ego. There's just nothing. There's just the pure, blissful, utter relaxation of everything is as it's meant to be, and we're just moving through it, being an instrument of light in everything that we do. Swamiji said something interesting about, he said it just a few years before he died, and he said, whereas most people in their lives, he said, become more and more disillusioned and unhappy as they grow older, and he says even as a devotee, there's an inclination to be disappointed with the material plane. How can you not be? It's a very difficult world. He said, but the older I get, the more I realize that wherever God has put me is where God wants me to be, and therefore it's heaven. No matter what it is, it's just heaven, because it's where God wants me to be. I mean, he's also describing there's no cross current. So with us, we do have all these cross currents, and everything pulls on something else and it impacts something else. And we keep imagining that our masters think along the same lines that we do. And so as a consequence, we project onto them all the judgment, insecurity, inadequacy that is really only the actual definition of those knots. Because the fact of who you're upset about and who did what to you and why they did it and all of that, it in and of itself, it means nothing. All those personalities die and they go away. When I was in a huge karmic crack with this woman, and it was based really entirely on past life experiences in which neither of us had been very admirable and had created a lot of negative responses in one another, which there was nothing in this life really at all to even activate that kind of negativity toward each other, but we simply carried it in. And Swamiji, in an effective effort to defuse it, said quite simply, well, yes, both of you behaved horribly, but you've learned from it. You would never do that again. Meaning the people we were relating to didn't exist anymore. The jiva did. I mean, the two souls, she and I, were still working our way out. But the particular vibration of delusion that had allowed us to treat each other in just unconscionable ways, we had transcended that. So you see, it didn't exist anywhere, because neither jiva was on that vibration anymore or would have been capable of being on that vibration anymore. We had learned. So all of the specifics about who did what to who and all the karma that's there, everybody dies, everybody changes, goes on to something else, and all that you're left with is the vibration of consciousness. If you want to think of between complete delusion and self-realization as the keys on a piano, and every one of those actually has a vibration that can be reproduced, a certain whatever the frequency, that's the word, that creates that particular tone. And if you really want to think about it, there's self-realization. There's everything less than self-realization. Self-realization is pure Om, if you want to think of it that way, and everything else is a different frequency. And whether that frequency manifests as anger, as self-hatred, as suicide, as murder, as selfishness, as gluttony, promiscuity, the only reason you manifest those limited states of awareness is because your consciousness itself is vibrating on that level. Okay, does that make sense? So, I just want to finish one more thought. And then, so what we have to understand is, and this is absolutely fundamental to relating to a spiritual teacher, is that a spiritual teacher is a jiva, and that jiva is just like you, in essence, who has simply passed through all those frequencies, learned that they'll never find happiness, and then moved on. So what that also means is that there's absolutely nothing, there's no frequency vibration of consciousness that you can present to the teacher that he hasn't himself experienced. Now think about what that means. Whereas we think somehow we're in this state of tremendous failure, we're hopeless, we're never going to get anywhere, we've been given all these opportunities, we're squandering, make the list. It's really long. The master just says, literally, been there, done that. Although probably not in those words. But just, yeah, I understand. I remember. Literally, master remembers. And so their sympathy is not manufactured. And their support for you is not phony. It's like, yeah, I was there, and we move through it, don't we? So what could you present to a master that's going to shock him? Often speaking, just in my own tiny world, when I'm dealing with people and someone will come to me with something that's really troubling them, I just say, I really don't care what you think, what you've done, none of it matters to me. Please tell me the truth. Because if you tell me the truth, then we can work with it. And it's just like, nothing is shocking. We just are what we are. And we're knotted up in a certain way. And if this is how I'm vibrating, first of all, you never fool anybody, even if you can keep the details secret. Your vibrations speak louder than your words. With Swamiji, I tried to pretend for a couple of years that I was much more of many things that I wasn't. And he kept just making my life more and more impossible, very consciously, until finally it just cracked. And his wonderful attitude, comment to me was, "You never fooled me," just like that. "You never fooled me," he said. I just looked at him and said, "What a waste of time. I'd been working so hard to fool him." And what was I, who was I trying to fool? Really, I was trying to fool myself. Because I wanted to be better than I was. But I was so, just flagrantly vibrating my actual state of consciousness that my costume didn't fool him. Period. It's like Halloween. This is completely off the subject, but I'll just mention this. Saranya, as many of you know, has worked in the deaf community as an educator. And she's been part of the school where all the children learn sign language. And she said, at Halloween, no matter how they're dressed, when people start to sign, you know who it is. She said, signing is as individually identifiable as the voice. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. She said, so the costume gets, just like it would be if somebody was dressed in a completely covered, but when they speak, you know who it is. So when deaf people speak with their hands, you know who it is. Because self-expression, we just are what we are. Now, I'm going to pause. And did you have a question, Deepika? It does make sense, you're saying. Good. Phew, I thought you said it doesn't make sense. I thought, whoa, I've been talking for a long time. to your next vibration. But the only way, it's like if you're on the piano, we can't fly. We have to walk across each one of those keys. And so, wherever we're standing right now, we always imagine that some other karma than the karma I'm facing would be easier or better for me. And we're not at all interested in the karma that we actually have, and we're intensely interested in that karma over there, which is not the karma that we actually are on. I mean, we have to go from this one to this one. A very interesting point, which is only tangential here, is when Swamiji came to live at Mount Washington, he was so overripe, so to speak. He was only 22, but he was so intense about it and just so thrilled beyond imagination of expectancy to be there living with his guru. And he thought that everybody in the planet would want to be there. And Swamiji says everybody has a particular delusion that motivates them, and Swami's delusion is that if he can just explain it clearly enough, everyone will want to be on this path. And he said it's a delusion. He knows it's a delusion, but it serves him because it inspires him to constantly be trying to explain it. But he was just stunned to see how many people who actually even came to be disciples didn't stay. He just, it was completely incomprehensible to him that they would come, find Master, and then just drift off. But he's made the statement, and I've said these things before, but in this context especially, it's just immeasurably important. He said the reason they left was because in the presence of so much light, their own reality was revealed. And people did not want to know their own reality, and as a consequence felt the necessity to move away from the light. And it didn't have anything to do with Master, even though sometimes they would project it upon him. It was that too much self-knowledge. So if you're standing in shadow, you can't really tell. I don't have it now, but somebody hit me in the head at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is an ideal place to receive a wound. I myself caused it. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, somebody hit me in the head. There were these big crowds, and there was this narrow staircase, and somebody very slow was in the front. It was a single lane, but I'm a kind of a rodent in certain ways, and so I saw that I could just make a double lane. So I just started scurrying up the inner track, and just at exactly the right moment, somebody reached out to take the other rail when my head was right there and just whacked me just really hard right in the eye. It didn't really hurt much, and I just let it pass. It didn't mean anything. It meant that I'm always impatient, and there it was. It meant that I got up there a lot faster than I would have if I'd stayed behind. I didn't even flinch. I just kept going. But for a day or two, I just never looked in the mirror when the lights were on. And then all of a sudden I did, and oh my God, I had this huge black eye. And at first it was just like, where did this come from? Because I hadn't even remembered that I'd been hit. But I'm only saying it because it was such a perfect analogy. It was there, but there wasn't enough light for me to see that my whole eye was discolored up there. But then when there was light, it was an alarming picture. So we have these limitations. We think we're pretty nice. We think we're fairly detached. And then when there's a great deal of light cast upon us, then all of a sudden we discover. And the reality of light also is, I mean, this is why satsang and community and spiritual family are a blessing beyond measure. Because if you just live among very worldly, ordinary people who have no spiritual aspiration, if you even have a tiny bit, you begin to think of yourself as pretty impressive. Because compared to short people, you begin to look tall. But when you actually stand among people who are really serious on the spiritual path, you may realize that you're not nothing, but you're not as much as you thought you were. And so if you want to feel taller, then you just go back to the short people. And so to be able to really compare yourself to what's real, that's what I mean about the amount of light. But Swami said they left because they were finding out more than they wanted to know. I tell people also when I used to teach the Med 1 course, in the last class, I would explain to people why they would stop meditating. Even if you're very enthusiastic, I say one of the reasons you'll stop meditating it'll start working for you, because meditation increases your awareness, and you become aware of everything. You become aware of all the potential good, and you also become aware of limitations you didn't even consider, you didn't even know were there. And so the way to solve that is to reduce your awareness, so you stop meditating. Meditation doesn't create those limitations, it just creates the awareness of those limitations. So if I go back to sleep, then I don't have to deal with them anymore. Now, if you have anyone in your life, and I'll go back to the way human relationships mimic the divine relationships. I've been very blessed in my life with a few girlfriends, one in particular, who for reasons I really don't understand, in fact, she and I are both a little puzzled by it. We just have an utterly unconditional love for each other. We have very different personalities. She thinks that I'm nuts in a lot of ways, and much that I do she thinks is so misguided she can hardly stand it. But for reasons that are just given by God, she just loves me, and I always feel that. And I became aware, I mean, I've known her for many years, I became aware at a certain point of the degree of receptivity and relaxation I have in her company. That is a direct result of that utterly unconditional acceptance. And it's not a blind acceptance. She tells me when she thinks I'm completely out of my mind, which is not infrequently. But it never has any effect on her commitment to me as a friend and as a sister. Now, I feel extremely grateful that I have that relationship, have had that relationship in my life, because it shows one what is possible if you're not afraid. And it all comes down to fear, if you think about it. It's always about fear, always. In the Bible, perfect love casts out all fear. Fear and love are opposites. They're you know, when you fear, you don't love, and when you love, you don't fear. And it's the way they neutralize one another, perfect love. And when we're unafraid, nothing ever seems that difficult, does it? I mean, what is it that makes our shortcomings, why do we protect them? Because we think we won't be loved or accepted or will be exposed. I mean, the story is long. But if someone completely loves you, you're just able to just give them the whole story. Now, I'm going to go back again to how we feel, who we think the master is. And what does he have at stake? I mean, in the Festival of Light, which is something that's well worth referring to, from a life of perfect joy and freedom in God, willingly to accept limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of others. I mean, this is a master. He doesn't have anything, there's absolutely nothing in it for him. He does it for one reason, and he comes to help us. Now, wouldn't it be contrary to his entire purpose to not help us? I mean, he doesn't have any other reason to be here. Think about that. We are untying all these knots. We have a whole lot of reasons to be here. But the Master, nothing. He came for one purpose, to help us. So why would he not help us? And how would it help us for him not to just say, okay, so this is what we're working with. Okay, so we've got to get you out of that one and into this one. How are we going to do that? You know, what do you think? What's a good idea? And if we can just constantly work on receptivity, and to constantly work on receptivity is to constantly understand who the Master really is and not imagine him to be us. Does that make sense? I'd like to take a short break, and then we'll come back and we can just start. If you have questions or thoughts, we can start with those. Let's just take 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes. Get water, use the bathroom if you need to, but don't get too involved in anything else. All right? Yes. Do you mind, pardon me, do you mind speaking into the microphone?
Thank you. There's one question that I had been thinking about it, but I don't know how to put it together. But in a simple way, how can you, you shared a story about your karmas with one girl. How do you really clear karmas? Like, it's if it's affecting your health, and you have been praying to gurus and divine everyone, but it doesn't seem to be clearing up. And how do you move forward? I don't know how to.
Well, it's a question related to what we're talking about, so I'll take it on. I've had karmas that have lasted 30 years or more in this lifetime, tough karmas between people. So you can't say that it's not clearing up. You're saying that you're not finished. I remember this woman came to me for counseling. The first time she came to me for counseling, she was in this just mess, relationship mess. It was just a mess. This man, that man, this one from the past, that one from the future. And she came to me, and basically she'd come to me because she wanted to finish the karma. I said, well, you're going to have to find another counselor because you're not going to finish this karma. You are so deep in it, and it is such a mess. If you can progress at a quarter of an inch, that'll be a lot. And you have to start with the premise that the hole is as deep as you yourself dug. And you might regret it now, but if it's a deep hole, the hole is that deep because it seemed like a good idea to you at the time to respond in such a way that the knot would just get this snarled. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you did exactly this to that person, but somehow or another, you set the energy in motion. And you're not finished learning. And I don't mean to make that harsh, but people spend a tremendous amount of time feeling in some way that, one, things ought to be different than they are, that I'm trying so hard, why is nobody responding, and that this is, you know, I'm not making any progress. You have any idea if you're making progress or not. If you're swimming, if you're 50 feet down and you get up to 35 feet, it may still look exactly the same to you. What you're really saying is, I want it to be different. And I'm not meaning to be harsh, but I'm trying to say. So let me take that to a completely different set of attitudes. I do feel that a fundamental acceptance of the absolute justice of the law of karma is essential for spiritual life. And in fact, just interestingly, when we were in Israel, Diksha, who was with this whole time, she's Israeli born, even though she's American now, has American citizenship. And she was asking me whether or not I would be willing, whether I wanted, it wasn't like she was asking me to do it, but she asked me if I wanted to or felt drawn to try to bring the self-realization teachings to Israel. To lecture there. And it had come up at different times. Swamiji had raised the question to Shivani many years ago. And it just was an interesting thought, and I mulled it over for a while. But then I said it would be very difficult. And then I realized why. For various reasons that I don't want to go into at great length. It would be almost impossible to get the Israelis as a collective to accept the law of karma, because they are a persecuted minority and so many horrible things have happened to them, and the present politics of their situation are so impossible and so difficult for them to influence. And every Israeli almost undoubtedly has a horror story to tell of some atrocity that's been acted upon them, their friends, or their family. And then I'm supposed to say everything that happens is fair? I just didn't even know I was not willing to take it on, and I certainly don't think it's the moment there. And it's just too complicated. And I'm not sure it's the lesson that country's trying to learn right now. You know, every country has its own destiny, and people incarnate because they have a certain destiny fulfill, and the destiny of transcending the whole material plane and becoming completely inwardly, to evaluate everything on an inward and not an outward level, is just a certain frequency, and you have to be on it before you want to do it. And to get to it, you have to have other experiences first. So, if we're going to have a guru in our lives, and if we're going to really and genuinely relate to that guru, there has to be a lot of courage. There has to be a lot of courage to be able to face what has to be faced. And the first thing that has to be faced is whatever knots we've got in our consciousness, whether those knots are expressing completely in an independent state of anxiety, or a knot that's expressing in the fact that your brother-in-law has an absolutely irrational dislike of you, you know, or one of your children is just impossible, or your husband has a drinking problem, or whatever it might be, however that knot may express, you've come here to work it out. And you haven't come here to not work it out. And working out to us means, oh, I try it for a little while and then it should stop. And if it doesn't stop, then then there must be something else going on. But that indicates a fundamental lack of the guru's attention to us, and also a fundamental lack of humility and just simple, honest self-acceptance that, well, I guess I'm not done. You know, I'd like to be done. I'd like to say that I'm finished, but you can tell by the fact that you're still upset that you're not finished. And even the fact that you're still upset that it's not finished is part of the knot. You don't even know a lot of times what you're working on, which is even worse. So you think you're supposed to be working on, you know, getting this thing perfect. This is often, very often, what we're doing. We think, I'm supposed to be working on getting this thing perfect. No, you're supposed to be working on perseverance. And there's just absolutely no value in having this problem solved, because your real weakness is lack of perseverance or lack of faith. Or lack of creative determination in the face of obstacles. So the obstacles really have no essential value at all. The only thing that matters is that you need to face them. So we're always, again, evaluating it, all figuring it all out, whereas the master is just moving us step by step. Now, which comes down to a complete other side of this, which is like, what are the right attitudes that we need to have? And the most important one is to realize that God has never abandoned us and your guru is always helping you. And if you're not feeling it, it only means that you're not feeling it. It doesn't mean that he's not helping you. And unfortunately, we make too much of how we feel. And Sister Gyanamata says this. I've read this for decades and I've only just begun to understand it. So I know it's not easy to understand. She says, and her words are almost exactly, even granted that the right kinds of feelings are desirable, just don't pay any attention to how you feel. Just do the right thing. Just go forward. But our measurement is constantly, how do I feel? How do I feel? How do I feel? Am I feeling joy? Am I not feeling joy? Am I feeling God's presence? Am I not feeling God's presence? And what we're doing is, what about me? What about me? What about me? What about me? And how magnetic is that? And how much room is there for God to give us what he needs when we're always raising our hands and saying, what about me? What about me? What about me? What about me? And the ego gets it in an odd way, you know. But I'm supposed to be joyful. And I'm not joyful, so there must be something wrong. And then all of a sudden we've just flipped out into a very simple concept, self-concern. at a certain point, I understood on the spiritual path. I used to think the spiritual path was self-perfection. And so I was always nervous because I was so clearly not perfect. And I was failing in this way and failing in that way. But the result of that was that I was always self-concerned. Now, think about how much of an instrument of God you can be when your entire concern is about yourself. What are people thinking of me? What are they not thinking of me? What am I feeling? What am I not feeling? Why isn't God with me? And actually, on the spiritual path, it's self-forgetfulness. That you just are not even, you know, you feel good today, you feel bad tomorrow. You feel inspired today, you feel dull tomorrow. And we just don't make that much of how we feel. It's we have our vision is there. And we're just moving through all of this, but we're always noticing where I'm going. What difference does it make how I feel? What would I do differently? And so this we have to come back to, I mean, fundamental attitudes. We need to come back to as clear and simple an idea of what my dharma is, and as inwardly defined a concept of that dharma as we can possibly get, so that we can always use it as a compass no matter where we are. And I come back to the 8 manifestations of God as one of the best ways I've found to be able to ask what my dharma is in all circumstances. Anya?
So the question that I have is, when you say it doesn't matter how you feel, but if I don't feel good, and I'm not self-concerned about that, and I just go and I do something that I know is good to do, and let's say that I start a project or something, is that negativity that I have in me going to impact my work? Or, and I mean, do I have to first get myself out of that mood or stupidity, or no? In order for the project to be positive.
It's a fine line that you're defining. And self-realization is not for everyone. And I'm not saying that it's not for you, but this has to be said. Self-realization presumes a certain degree of psychological health. And sometimes people who are psychologically not healthy like self-realization. Because, oh look, I never have to deal with myself at all. I never have to face my true feelings about anything. I never have to learn to speak the truth. I never have to resolve my inner conflicts. I'm just going to give it all to God. And it doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work. So there are subtleties that can only be individualized, where you have to ask yourself whether you're running away from self-honesty or whether you have the capacity to be self-honest and have now made a choice about what you're going to do with yourself. Okay? So because some people are not self-honest, don't want to be self-honest, so they decide, I'll just be nice all the time. And they become enablers of people who are not healthy. They're not really inspired, they're afraid all the time. I myself, when I was in my late teens, I realized that I was very nice and harmonious because I was just terrified to say anything that might be dissonant. And so I wasn't really living a truth, I was living, the motivating force of my nice personality was fear. It wasn't really that I was a nice person, it was that I was an intensely fearful person. And so what I had to get over was the fear. And now, okay, this comes down to, you want a definition of dharma that is as inwardly defined as possible so it will always work in all circumstances. So the 8 manifestations of God to my experience, and this is how to receive the power of a teacher. Okay, because I'm going to go off for a second into that to make it more clear. Master's vibration, the vibration of Jesus, of Swamiji, it's a frequency in the universe, and it's always there. And what they literally are doing in and out of their bodies is projecting a vibration of consciousness with enough force that we will perceive that vibration. Whether we perceive it by looking at a photograph, by when Swamiji was present, by being in the room with him, by listening to a recording, by suddenly feeling it in ourselves, but we will receive a vibration and we'll recognize that vibration as also at least a potential of my own or a dimension of my own. And we will also then be attracted to that vibration. I mean, there are people who come in and out of this temple. There are people who came in and out of Swami's life. They neither recognized the vibration nor were they attracted to it. It just wasn't theirs. They either went and found another teacher or they got into sports. I mean, they just did something completely else because it wasn't the next key on the piano for them. So now the master's constantly projecting his vibration of self-realization. And we are nothing but sound vibrations. So a part of us is vibrating with that and a part of us is vibrating with dissonance. And so we sense his vibration, we try to merge into it, and as much of us as is aligned with that vibration, to that extent we're able to go into it. And to the extent that we're still afraid of this and holding on to this and worried about that and concerned about this, we will merge this much and then that will pull us out of tune with it. Exactly like singing. On this trip, I haven't sung the oratorio alto parts very much, but I know them pretty well. But Lisa Powers was there. She sings them very well. And so most of the time, if I stood really close to her, I could just sing right with her, and I could match her voice and make the vibration match. If I was too far away from her, I found that I was wandering off, and God knows what I was singing. You know, I just suddenly realized that I was singing something completely else. Because I wasn't melded enough. So the way it happens with singing or dancing or anything where you have to move, where you move in unison, but singing's the most powerful, it's exactly what's happening. The vibration is right there, but we have lots of other melodies in our minds, and so we get into the right melody and we hold it and then we fall away from it. Pilgrimage is very dramatic that way because we're moving from place to place, and sometimes the places we were calm, sometimes they were just chaotic. But every so often, the vibration, you just match the vibration. When I was at the Mount of Transfiguration, we were just standing sort of on the outside the church, off to the side, because it was a quiet spot. And we sang a song or two, and just, you know, vibration just matched. And the group went off to do something. I was leaning against the wall. I just slid to the ground and I just sat there because the vibration matched. And that's what happens to us. So to be receptive is to match your vibration to the guru's vibration. The guru's vibration is always the same. It's ours that's always fluctuating. And the guru's vibration has nothing to do with any of the details of your life. It has to do with your frequency in the midst of it. And all of the karmic messes that we've made, you know, in this incarnation and all the ones before, I mean, they're just, you don't even want to think about it. It's just so enormous. However, in the moment, none of that is happening. All that's happening is what vibration you're attuned to in the midst of it. If you've set it up so that you have all these circumstances, the brother-in-law who doesn't like you, the child who's just impossible, the financial situation that can't be helped, the health condition that can't be changed, you know, those are just the holes that you've dug that you now have to get yourself out of. But what you're vibrating on in the midst of it, that is your dharma. That's the only dharma that you have, is what vibration do I choose? And we think, and this is what I was saying before, I used to make myself so anxious because I was always trying to perfect myself and my conditions. And so my actual vibration was one of constant anxiety. Now, let me think, is that Master's vibration, constant anxiety? So when I would, you know, even pray for Master's grace, the vibration was one of so much self-concern and so much anxiety that very little grace could get through to me. Well, I won't say that. I wasn't able to feel necessarily that God was helping me. But what choice did I have? You know, it was like, it doesn't matter. This is the karmic hole I'm in. And I'm certainly not going to get out of it by running away from it. All I'm going to do is just create another whole karmic mess that I'm just going to have to work out and come back to this point. I might as well, as Master said, fight the battle for joy right where I stand. So, Master, I'll go now to the 8 manifestations, which are love, joy, peace, calmness, energy, which is power, energy. Energy is an easier way to understand it. Light, sound, and wisdom. Okay, these are, classically speaking, and I can't defend why it's these 8, but it's fascinating that it is. This is the way the divine manifests in this world. And so by definition, those 8 manifestations, if you're in one of those vibrations, you're going to be aligning yourself with the ray of that power that's coming in. And what I have found about those manifestations is, once I get it in my head that this is what my dharma is, I can usually at least move toward one of them. And wisdom is a very helpful one over here, because maybe I'm not at all calm. There's no peace in my life. I may not even have a lot of energy at that moment. But wisdom, what would be the wisest way to respond to this total collapse of my life situation? Okay, and wisdom might be to just say, well, these things happen and this too shall pass. Which is entirely different than creating a whole nother layer of confusion based on the fact of why does this always happen? Why don't I get saved? Why aren't you listening to me? Well, he's not, so there you have it. You know, God is not listening to me. I'm presently abandoned. I have no sense of God. But what would be the wisest way to respond to this situation? Patient endurance. And even in my present state of absolute limitless despair, just keep a piece of me remembering everything passes. And you might not be able to talk yourself out of it in the moment, but just a little piece of you. Just one of the 8 manifestations is wisdom. So what would be the wisest way to respond to the state of complete delusion? It would be to remember that yesterday was different and tomorrow might also be different. And then that may be all you have, but you see it's still there. Or calmness, or respond with energy. Energy is one that I use a great deal. Sometimes when I can't do something wise, I just at least do something that's not lazy. Like if I have projects I have to work on or something that needs to be done, and for reasons of my own, which are always unfathomable even to me, I don't really feel like doing it. I can still not lie in bed and watch a movie. Or before I lie in bed and watch a movie, I can at least put a load of laundry in. You know, just put out like a little bit of energy. And then here I am watching a movie again instead of X, Y, and Z that I ought to be doing it. Well, at least I can be calm about the fact that I'm not as good at as I hope to be. That my discipline isn't yet what I want it to be. So I can manifest calmness. I'm not manifesting wisdom, but I can at least be calm about my ignorance. But you see how it works? And joy, of course, is tremendously useful. Because when we lose joy, we lose everything. So here I am, and I'm going to go dancing tonight instead of staying home and doing what I know I ought to do. I'll at least be joyful. I'll at least be a bubble of bright light to everyone I meet. And at least be a cheerful presence in the midst of all of this. And lift a few other people's spirits. And your actions are not wise, but at least they're energetic and joyful. Does that make sense? Okay, so receptivity. What makes us receptive? Receptive is to be on the same wavelength. And bearing in mind that the Master can match, can come all the way to where we are. There's a story in the Miracles and Answered Prayers book, Loved and Protected, and the man writes, "You may not think you can be a devoted disciple of Master and a drug addict at the same time," he said, "but I'm here to say you can be." And he just made that as a statement, and that was that. We need a microphone over here. And he said, not surprisingly, my favorite quote of Master was, "If you're going to do it anyway, bring me with you." So he said, "I took Master to a lot of unsavory places. I don't know if he enjoyed himself or not, but I took him at his word." I mean, it's a humorous story, but there's a lot of anguish in that story. It's told lightly, but it wasn't light when it happened. But that was wisdom. Yes.
Can you talk about refining our receptivity so that it is more directly connected and linked with Master or with the teacher instead of... I think I tend to be overly receptive to things that are also not helpful.
Yeah. That's a very good question. Let me hold it for just a second here. I had an experience on this trip which was sort of interesting, which was Israel itself as a country is just bleak and barren in so many places. Not, I mean, what the Israelis have done is stunning. It's just in whatever it's been 60 or 80 years, just... We were in this kibbutz way in the middle of the desert, and the view out my window was of this fabulous, barren desert landscape. And we had also by that time experienced these oases in the desert where you just suddenly, in fact, from that place we took this walk through barren desert and then up a canyon, and all of a sudden there's waterfalls, and we go into this huge mossy grotto with this water falling from several hundred feet above us, and beautiful, then hiked back out to this horrible barren desert again. Not horrible, but intense. I mean, I liked it, but very intense. So we're staying in this beautiful complex with gardens and this fabulous swimming pool and this health spa, and all around is this very barren area. So I'm just naturally assuming that they put the kibbutz, when they started it in whenever, 1940 or so, at a oasis. But they didn't. And I later found out that they just chose a spot that was absolutely barren. The water was a whole kilometer away. But they chose it because it was militarily secure. It was up on a rise, and it was a safer place than where the water was. So they pumped the water. Now, what was the point of that? Just give me just a moment to... say this. This is about perfecting your receptivity. Oh, yes, I know. But you know, a lot of what was being told to us was very, very ancient history, and I don't trust history because so much of what we were talking about happened through the nadir of Kali Yuga. You know, the nadir of Kali Yuga was 500 AD, and much of everything was just simply destroyed, descending. And so we're coming back up the other side, but there's this huge burning hole in the middle between that time and this time. And Swami has often commented, Master commented too, that deserts come in to purify land when energy has gotten out of hand. Swami said that's part of what's happening in Africa, was that there was too much black magic at one point. And so a lot of the big desert areas are just being purified from that. So I keep wondering whether Jesus actually had to deal with such harsh conditions or whether the country was not greener. Because what the Israelis are making happen in what was otherwise completely barren in less than a century tells you how much human participation can shift and how the evidence of that could just be changed and changed. Maybe there's a good answer to that, I don't know. This is a long story, but it has a very good point. So I had with me some things that Swamiji had said and written in relation to the oratorio, which he wrote in relation to Israel. And one of the narratives that he'd written, which was one part of the early oratorio that he wrote, had two different references to Israel having been, he referred to the emerald hills of Israel that are now being restored. And in another place, the now barren land is blooming once again, references to the fact that it wasn't always like this. Now, to me, that was an enormously important piece of information, because I'd rather take Swami's word for it than anybody else's. And I'm not, as Swami said about himself and Master, he said, I accepted what Master said unhesitatingly, but not unquestioningly. You see the difference? It's that he didn't have any doubts about Master's wisdom, but that didn't mean that he just became mindless himself. He often had to hammer it down for a very long time before he was willing to. But if Master said it, he couldn't reject that. So to me, this was absolutely definitive. This was the beginning of a conversation. And I was impressed by the fact that it wasn't so for everyone. Now, I don't want to judge my guru bias, because it was all too casual and I wasn't going into it deeply enough. So I don't want to say that was people's really true response or anything like that. And I didn't talk to everyone. But it struck me that, oh yes, this is the way I've trained myself to think over a very long period of time. Is that I have spent a lot of time really trying to learn this path. You know, not the path, but this path. And that doesn't mean I've never read or studied outside of it, but very little from the beginning, very little. And only that which is compatible. I mean, really compatible, not just almost the same, but really compatible. And I've applied my consciousness very hard to understand what is really compatible. And I always start from there. I always start from what would Master have said about this. And I don't get excited. People will come to me a lot of times, and I don't mean to be rude, but this happens all the time. You'll love this book. It's almost like Master's teachings. Why would I want something that's almost like Master's teachings when I actually have Master's teachings? And maybe it's helpful to other people. And there's a lot of stuff that's written these days that people will say, well, this communicates to me and I understand it. It's a matter of frequency. But personally, I don't. Because it's not Master's teachings. It's always not quite as clear or not quite as mine. It's, you know, it doesn't speak to me in the same way. But I've trained myself that way. And I didn't train myself this way in 6 months, this is 45 years. But I always understood that I really needed to learn what I needed to learn. And I just didn't have the time or the bandwidth to learn everything. I really wanted to understand this. And I wanted to start with what these masters said about it. And I glued myself to people who could teach me. And I was constantly raising questions. I was so annoying. Just constantly, you know, trying to get people who understood to answer my questions. And I would try to figure out the pieces. How does this go together? And I'm very, very verbal is actually the right word. But I pushed hard for clarity. What I really wanted was clarity. Sometimes I've had people say, well, I'm not intellectual. Or even more, they will say, well, I'm not mental. But sometimes what they are saying is, I don't want to be that clear. Yeah. So you can be very, very clear with your feelings. It's not like you have to bring things to words. This is just something that I do. I bring the difference between falling away and stepping back. You know, I just can't help myself. Swami Kriyananda said, when I said that the P.G. Woodhouse story was, let me think, ridiculously entertaining. Swamiji said, no, you mean entertainingly ridiculous. And then he said, the editor never sleeps. And so I'm the same way. The editor never sleeps. But you have to bring things to a clear focus. That's why Swami called it Crystal Clarity when he finally named his publishing company. So one can't let one's enthusiasm, one's good-heartedness, one's desire to please others, one's desire for everybody to be happy, to cause you to fuzz the edges of things. You have to just fight against that. That's not wisdom. You might call that joy. You might even call that love. But it's not wisdom. Wisdom is to know exactly what's happening. Then you can choose to be enthusiastic anyway. But to be enthusiastic because you're not clear enough to realize I should restrain myself a little bit here. I mean, I learned that from Swami when I was writing letters for him. And this woman sent us, this is in the Swami Kriyananda book, this woman sent us her poetry, or a man, I don't know who. And I composed letters for Swamiji, and he would read them and edit or rewrite them or sign them if he thought that I had intuited his thoughts correctly. Thank you for your beautiful poetry. He said, Asha, that poetry wasn't beautiful. He said, what will you say when someone actually sends us beautiful poetry? He said, now that you've wasted this word. And it was just absolutely right. I had just been too lazy and not clear enough. Oh, thank you for the beautiful poetry. But Swami always wanted to say. And actually, it was nice poetry. It wasn't that good. But Swami was still very glad to have received it. So what we said was, I'm so glad to see that you're writing poetry. And I was so happy to read what you've written. You know, and then he made a comment about, you know, one image or another. But he didn't say it was beautiful poetry because it wasn't. But truth and wisdom said, let's encourage this person. Let's let them know that I want to hear from them. Let's be enthusiastic about their creativity. But let's not be so fuzzy-minded that we're just going to say, oh, the poetry was beautiful. And so that's what we have to watch for, is that we just get sort of swept along and think that to be spiritual is to just be nice. And to not have the wisdom and the courage to stand calmly, even if it's going to upset other people. You know? And you just have to stop and ask really clearly, what is trying to happen here? And then, how would Swami have handled this? Because Swamiji wasn't really nice. He was marvelously supportive and completely loving, but he wasn't nice if nice wasn't appropriate. But somehow you could always take it from him because he was completely accepting of you. But he didn't try to win your acceptance by being nice. If the clear, honest response to it was not nice. He would just, I mean, I've seen him many times say things like, you know, I really want to support you, but I have to be sincere. And you would just be so grateful because then you knew he was going to tell you the truth. I would have to be sincere. I don't really know, you know, I'm not really sure that this is going to work, or I don't really feel in tune with what you suggested. Or I'm really concerned about the decision you're making. And if you weren't receptive, he would find another way, like a story I tell. Woman, man, asked him to bless a certain course of action that he knew would prove disastrous. And he couldn't say this is going to prove disastrous because the person didn't want to hear it. So Swami did something or another, and the person said, well, you will bless me, won't you? And Swami said, I always bless you. The person walked out of the room saying, oh, Swami approves. Swami did not approve, and it ended disastrously. But he did always bless that person. And he blessed them all through it. But he took the time and put out the energy to know exactly what was true. And then responded. Is that relevant? Okay. You know, and so therefore you have to do those things that you, and this is another aspect of that, and I'm giving you basic ideas here. You have to do those things that you can do, and you need to do them as well as you can. And you need to put out a lot of energy in what you do work with. And this is where Swami's principles always was, go with your strengths. You know, that which you can do that you know puts you in tune, do more and more of that. Swami had me cooking, of all things, for a long time. And he taught me to cook himself. And what he did was he awakened my intuition through the medium of cooking. And I cooked a lot, and I became very good at cooking and very intuitive about cooking, and I learned about intuition. And it worked for me because I really liked to serve people. And I was too mentally confused to do anything else, but cooking I could do. But I learned what it felt to be intuitive because I went with something that was working for me. And because I did it with full energy and I was wide awake, I was able to then turn that to other things later on. So you take what you can already do and what you do best or may do well, and do more of it, because in the doing of that. And I think the music and the chanting is probably the single most important way that we have of being receptive, because it's pure sound and it just shifts us. We had this woman that Swamiji took an interest in. Her name was, I believe it was Sherry Edwards. She was a sound healer. This happened about 25 years ago. She had the capacity, just like people can see auras, she could hear your unique om vibration. And she could hear what tones were missing in your vibration. Yeah, she was quite something. And then she could tone them. She could heal you by toning them. And she discovered her ability when her daughter was severely injured when they were out in a semi-wilderness area, and they were about an hour from the hospital. And her daughter was in danger of bleeding out from the injury. And she found that she could stop the bleeding with the right sounds. And she saved her daughter's life by toning her all the way to the hospital and holding the bleeding. Yeah, she was quite a remarkable lady. Now, as often happens, she decided that she wanted to turn what was her unique ability into a machine that would make the right tones. And you know, just people have their ideas about things. So we spent months. Swami was extremely interested in her methods because it's so dwapara and it's so about the om. You know, he was fascinated by it. So we spent months working with this and buying the machines and trying to make them work. And in the end, it was just a disaster. In every way except just her. But at the very end of this disastrous many months of effort together, she said this: "Oh, you don't need these machines. You're chanting, you're singing. It does exactly the same thing for you." And it was true, because she could see and she could hear it. She could hear that when we all came together to sing or to chant, everybody's vibrations went in order. Now, isn't that an interesting thing? And so we mustn't ever not take advantage of what's given to us. That's why Swami suggests that we all sing. And those people who can do more, but everybody can at least listen or sing in private. But what that does is that gradually, even though you think it's unrelated, just like, I don't know why making a good minestrone soup helps me now to be a good writer, but I know that there was a direct line because I was able to just kind of learn how not to worry and just do it. And then when I had to face the things that I was intensely worried about, I could still just sort of vaguely remember how that system worked. And so if we're listening to the music or listening to Swami speak or hearing Master's voice or chanting, then we kind of know what it feels like to be where we're supposed to be. And it gives us a point of reference. And it also, literally, the chants wake you up in the middle of the night. There was a story Swami used to tell about he had an album out and it had the song, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ramo. And this woman used to play it a lot in her home, and she got angry at her 2-year-old son, and he looked up at her and he said, Sri Ram, Jai Ram. Because he'd observed that this calmed mommy down. He was hoping it would work. Yeah. But it does calm us down. So this is the arsenal of how do you get back to one of the 8 manifestations when you're off. And the other side of it is, so what I've said here is, I think one should really try to learn these teachings as much as you can apply yourself to do it. And everybody has a different way. I mean, some people learn these teachings literally just by singing all the songs. I mean, I find that the words to those songs, that the whole philosophy of Swami's, all of the path is in the words to those songs. So if you just learn the words to those songs and then the melodies that go with them, you never have to open a philosophical book in your life if you actually really learn and listen to them. Or you can study in the way that I've studied, or you can listen to Swami teach. But then when there's an issue of any kind, you always use this teaching as the reference point. And when it's clearly there that, you know, this ray has expressed this reality, don't say, well, I prefer to think, or recognize what's going to happen to you if you say that. It's that you'll just move a little off. And when you really want that energy, you'll have moved a little off. Yes, Atma Jyoti.
We were making, or Amy made minestrone soup, but we
which,
sang.
By the way, I've never made well. Go ahead. It was an odd example.
But it just brought it to mind that we sang the blessing song, and there. In fact, you may have been there. And when we got to the Om, I mean, the blessing song, everyone was sort of their own, doing their own thing. When we got to the Om, the tone was just so astral. I mean, it was the most beautiful attunement to each other that I think I've ever heard.
Interesting.
It just, and all of us were just silent after because it was just so beautiful. So it was a direct, demonstration.
And that's why coming to church every Sunday, you know, being part of the Festival of Light, even if you think you're not really there, something always happens, at least a little bit. But let me get that other point. Here's also what you have to understand. And you just said something that's extremely important to understand. Delusion does not last, but spirit is eternal. And our nature is eternal, and the only enduring part of us is eternal. All the rest of this story, which looms quite large in our mental sky at this point, actually is ephemeral. And ultimately, it's not merely that it becomes the past. We perceive that it doesn't exist and never really existed. It was a mist obscuring the true light. You know, there's a true light, and then there's a mist which obscures it. Or think of it a different way.
Let me think about how I would say this exactly.
It was just a misunderstanding. We thought we were suffering. We thought we were unhappy. We thought that we weren't loved. We thought that we'd done the wrong thing. We thought that we failed in this way. We thought that we died. We thought that we murdered this person. We thought that we were murdered. But we never actually were. It's like, our costume got torn. But that which we gradually come to understand is actually me was never touched. It's just like the little child just gets so dirty. There's a one of the little things on the internet too that I've seen. One that I saw that was fun was where like a 3-year-old girl painted her 1-year-old brother completely with peanut butter. There's just, and the mother's pulled out her little phone and she's talking to the daughter about, well, you painted your brother completely with peanut butter. And then there's the little kid smiling through the peanut butter. He doesn't know the difference. And of course, I just loved it. And so, that mother will pick up that child and take him into a shower somewhere and get all the peanut butter off of him because he's not really covered with peanut butter. He hasn't become peanut butter, he's just covered with peanut butter. And he will emerge. And in the moment, the mother knows that her child will emerge from all that peanut butter. And so the mother's not panicked about it. And the child, it doesn't care at all. Because he's just he's having a happy time. He doesn't know he's covered with peanut butter because it hasn't happened to him. What he knows to be himself. So was the child ever peanut butter? Not really. It was just that his true physical form was obscured by the peanut butter, so to speak. So what happens to us, all the masters say this, and I'm sure you've had enough moments that you know it, that the point comes where we just suddenly see through all of those wrong vibrations. And we just, it doesn't mean anything to us anymore because they didn't even really happen. No, there was never any sorrow. There was never misunderstanding. There was never misbehavior. It swirled around us, but it never really happened. The only thing that ever happened was that we were always a perfect reflection of the infinite. So every time, and I think no matter how small, you know, it suddenly comes together, even for a second, that really happens. And nothing else really happens except that. So part of what we are working with all the time is just to have as many moments like that as we can, and then to pass the time in between, waiting until it comes back together again. And unfortunately, if you have to wait a long time, what difference does it make? Because in the end, but the spiritual path is not for weaklings. And no amount of weeping and wailing and wanting it to be different will change your, will make it different. The only thing that will make it different is, as, what is it, the British who say, pull your socks up and just go. No, just say, all right, now that I'm done having my tantrum, whether that tantrum has been many incarnations or just a couple of days, what do I do now? Love, peace, joy, wisdom, calmness, which one of them do I have the slightest hold on at this moment, and how can I get back to it? And then you have to see that the Master has just been standing over here, just radiating the same note. I mean, they're amused. There's that incredible story of Dr. Ritchie dying when he was in his 20s of the flu epidemic in the World War II, and he died when he was in the army, and he was drawn up into the light, and he had to confront Jesus, and he had to recognize when he's looking at his life review that he's just been a selfish, kind of self-centered, nasty lad most of his life. What happened to him, as he described it, was his mother died when he was young, and his grandparents, his maternal grandparents, just wanted him never to forget his mother. And his father remarried, and his stepmother was lovely and was always trying to help him, but he always let them influence him. So he was uncooperative and unkind and very cruel to her, and, you know, and unkind to his father. And he was very ashamed of himself when he suddenly saw it as it was. But he allowed them to influence him. And he kept trying to plead that he was young and he didn't know, but Jesus wasn't hearing it. He just wasn't hearing it. He kept saying, how much did you love? And he kept saying, I was just a boy, I didn't really know. And Jesus very calmly just kept saying, how much did you love? And he had to say, not very much. And he saw this picture of his poor stepmother and how often she tried to help him and how often he'd rejected her, and the dismay of his father, and every time he'd just taken a selfish step. And he was very ashamed. And the whole picture of his life, as he was standing in what he described as a 360-degree simultaneous movie of every incident of his entire life, including coming out of his mother's womb, he's looking at all of it, and Jesus is standing there with him, and there's nothing to be proud of. He's 20 years old, 22, and he kept trying to say, I never had a chance. And Jesus just kept saying very calmly, how much did you love? And so then he saw that when he'd been an Eagle Scout, he'd done something that was slightly more less selfish than everything else. And he said, he describes that he tried to sort of point to that thing and at the same time make his body as big as possible so that he would obscure some of the less attractive incidents, hoping that he could distract Jesus' attention from the rest of the sorry story to this one little thing over here. And as he did that, this is the way Dr. Ritchie says that he's a Southerner. The Savior was amused. He was amused. And he could just see right through him, you never fooled me. But he wasn't judgmental. That's what Dr. Ritchie suddenly saw. He was just amused. You know, we never think about the Master's having a sense of humor, but really, this is very funny. You know, here this guy has just made a complete hash of the first 22 years of his life, and so he's trying to cover up. You never fooled me. And in that moment, what happened was Dr. Ritchie realized that he was loved. He'd been trying to, you know, earn it, become worthy, all this stuff. And he suddenly just accepted what Jesus was trying to give him. And then everything changed. He came back into his body. He became a psychiatrist. He did much good work for decades and decades. But the Savior was amused is a phrase that just, you have to just keep that always in your mind. Because the only thing that matters, because as soon as you turn toward the light, everything else literally ceases to exist. This is why Swamiji said, you know, many times in his life, I'm very proud of the way I've lived. That's how he said it. You know, I've made mistakes. I've made lots of mistakes, but I'm very proud of the way I've lived. I've done the best I could do, and I've loved God. That's all I've ever loved. And it wasn't merely that I've forgiven myself. I realized that nothing ever happened. All that ever happened was this effort toward the light. And just we just have to pull ourselves back to that. This is not easy. This really is not easy. Because everything about these knots. But this, you see, is what's wrong. It's not that I was so unkind here, that I did this to this person, that I wasn't competent in this way. None of that is what matters. What matters is that we have allowed ourselves to feel, therefore, I'm not worthy of God's love. Make your dharma really internal. Yes.
You made a comment earlier about the importance of paying attention to what you do as opposed to what you feel. And it was a good reminder for me. And one of the things an image that I use for myself is, you know, if I go to a pile of weights every day and I pick it up and I move it, regardless of what I think or how I feel, I'm going to get physically strong. And the same thing, if I choose to do certain spiritual practices, takes certain spiritual actions, which I know is going to bring me more into the light, help me to get more attuned, I'm going to get more spiritually strong, regardless of what I may have felt or thought, you know, prior to doing those things. And then also, something that I've observed in myself is, if I take those actions, it also tends to change positively what I do feel and experience.
Exactly.
And so that's been, you know, something that's been helpful for me.
And we must understand, you know, the word feeling, feelings on many levels. You know, there's refined intuitive feelings, and then there's just more, I'm happy because I'm pleased sort of feelings. And that's what Gyanamata was particularly talking about. You know, the ups and downs of feelings, you just simply cannot run your life on that basis. And you can't imagine for a moment that your spiritual life is actually defined by those fluctuating levels of feeling. And this is important because several of you said that, how can I feel more of the time that God is with me? Well, it's a very, very high level of awareness to always feel that God is with you. I mean, that's what saints feel all the time. It's not like we can just sort of, we set unrealistic standards for ourselves so that we can fail all the time. It's much more important to be able to persevere with courage and to do something as positive as we're able to in the moment, or to endure our failures with calm wisdom. That's a much more realistic thought than I'm always going to feel God's presence. So that's why I was trying to say, just figure out what your dharma is, tune into one of the eight manifestations and try to do it. And don't make it that I'm moment by moment, God is always whispering in my ear, because that in itself makes us a little self-concerned. Am I being guided? Yes, I'm being guided. Am I being guided? Yes, I'm being guided. Am I being guided? Yes, I'm being guided. But there's so much of the personal pronoun in that. Absolutely, that's exactly right. That vibration can be increased. But you can't just weigh and measure it and think that your weighing and measuring has anything to do with what's actually going on. I've watched now, and it's become very interesting. I'll say her name. Well, there's a woman. I won't say her name. There's a woman at Ananda who's facing a terminal health sentence now. And it's probably, you know, it's probably going to happen that she's not going to live much longer. She's had a very, very challenging life. She's had to face many, many ups and downs and very difficult karmas, of a relatively worldly kind, addictions and relationships and, you know, marriage failures, all sorts of things. You know, you would think, just watching on the external, you know, that this woman didn't really have her act together. But she's victorious. And I've lived long enough with a spiritual path that I've seen that the short-term measure is not the measure. The only measure is if you don't give up. And that just has to be said so powerfully and has to be said over and over again, and you have to keep saying that to yourself. It doesn't really matter whether I'm succeeding or failure. The point is I'm going to keep trying. And if I've just messed it up completely again, well, here I am. And we're just going to have to start over from here. Swamiji told us the story, has told us the story many times. He's gotten it from his Bhrigu reading and from the Agastya reading and from various other things of, you know, really turning against, arguing with his guru, turning against his guru, taking disciples from his guru, leaving his guru. I mean, he's not done it 100 times, but there's been at least two, and maybe 3 lifetimes where he reached a very advanced spiritual state and then had a falling out with his guru. And then Swami just says it all very lightly, you know, and then I argued with my guru and I went away and I lost that state. But think of all the space in between, you know, from becoming so deluded as to take that action, then the defending of your action, then the gradual realization of the mistake you've made, then the despair that would set in, then the hopelessness, then gathering yourself up again. I mean, think about that cycle. And there you are. So we just keep doing what we keep doing. And at the end of it, we're victorious because the Master said, if you don't quit, they'll help you. And that's the only measurement. And we can
create our future. Guru's background, where they lived, actually. Like, I'm still learning. Right. But you said, Srila Hari Mahasaya, he's the one who lived in Varanasi. He's the only one who lived there? Or Sri Yukteswar also lived there?
Sri Yukteswar's mother lived there. And in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda says he met Sri Yukteswar in Varanasi, but Sri Yukteswar was visiting his mother there. And whether okay. And Sri Yukteswar's ancestral home was in Serampur, and then he built the ashram in Puri, so it doesn't sound like Varanasi was ever his home.
But in the movie Awake, there was a home, there was a scene, I don't remember.
But it was a scene of Yogananda meeting Sri Yukteswar, and that was in Varanasi. That was in Varanasi, and then they also had Lahiri's home. They had the doorway of Lahiri's home in the movie also, which is also in Varanasi.
Like there was a scene that Sri Yukteswar was standing on the
right, and that was in
roof.
Varanasi. That's what I'm saying to you.
Yes.
He was there visiting his mother. Yogananda was a
like
young boy
young,
in an
yes.
ashram, and they met there. But it wasn't because Sri Yukteswar lived there. He was visiting his mother,
okay.
And they met there. And then Sri Yukteswar went back to his home in Serampore. Yogananda went back to his family home in Calcutta.
And then
that's when they began their training.
The reason I'm asking you, because many times I see that in my meditation, and I cannot relate it. I'm like...
Well, but of course, Varanasi is one of the holiest cities in the world, one of the most long-standing, established cities in the world. How many lifetimes have we all lived there?
Yeah.
How many times have we taken pilgrimage to that city in how many different bodies? I mean, the first time I went there, it was like, oh, well, finally, here we are.
Yes.
You know, and I'd never even seen the place before, but it was...
Yes.
And, you know, Varanasi is one of those cities, especially 30 years ago, that was not at all pleasant to be in.
It's still very crowded.
But I just loved it. It was completely irrational, had nothing to do with present reality. So, of course, we would see those images.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're just many lifetimes. Yeah, it's just, it is what it is. When we would travel on pilgrimage, especially at the beginning when sometimes people would get sick one way or another, we would always say, well, if you're going to die, don't waste it, you know, here in Srinagar. Wait till we get to Varanasi. Because the tradition is you'll be liberated if you die in Varanasi.
People still do that.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that would be always our advice. People are throwing up and they think they're going to die. No, no, don't die here. Complete waste. Hold on. Varanasi, that would be the place. We never lost a pilgrim.
So that is the reason, like maybe in one of my life, past life, I had lived
there. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying it could be.
Because I see that Guruji, Shri Yukteswar standing, exact the same scene from the movie. He's standing and Yoganandaji is standing there and he's watching him from the roof. And I have seen that many times. I'm like, maybe they are telling me that they are watching me.
Okay, you asked me a question and I'll... go ahead, you wanted to say?
That location is in Serampore. The one that you're describing where he's on the balcony and Master arrives?
There's that one. There's several scenes. But, you know, also it's hard to say exactly where it is. But pause. Okay, that's not the issue. You asked me the question which really should be answered, and it's the same question. How can you tell where guidance is coming from? When something happens to you in meditation, how do you know what it really is? Okay. Swamiji said... and I just read this recently, that superconscious intuition is often a mixture of superconscious and subconscious. And so the end point about how can you tell whether the masters are really guiding you, since this is all about how to draw spiritual power from your teacher, is that it's not easy. And you need to be very humble about it. And don't get this thought in your mind that I need to be always guided by Master, and therefore I am always being guided by Master, because the possibility for self-delusion is enormous. Now, I need to say that very strongly. That doesn't mean to say that you can't be in a constant relationship or that you can't often be guided, but the necessity for humility on this particular issue is it cannot be overestimated, because people get themselves in an enormous amount of trouble by just assuming, because I felt it in meditation, because it feels right, that it is actually super conscious. See, what you have to realize is that we are a mixture of many levels of consciousness, and our subconscious is simply that which is familiar to us, which has been the way we've been and who we are. Our superconscious is our creative potential to expand into a greater reality. So naturally, things that are familiar to us, that we have lived in many lifetimes before, that is our habitual way of being, will feel very right to us. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to be guided according to what is natural and harmonious for you. And in fact, see, everything is progressive, is what you have to understand. Many people are so out of touch with themselves and so unaccustomed to living an inner life at all that they just do everything according to the fad of the moment. Swami himself made the statement many times toward the end of his life, people who follow the fashions have no taste. What he was trying to say is they take their values completely from outside. They don't have any inner sense of who they really are and really ought to be. And it's better to have a strong inner sense of who you are that is merely subconscious, which is to say habitual and familiar. It's far better to be moved entirely by that level of inner guidance than it is just to be subject to the world around you and have no inner direction. But what we really want to do is we want to gradually elevate that which is habitual to me to that which is really divinely inspired and therefore is expansive and will take me in a new direction. But guidance is very much more subtle and not nearly as clear-cut and obvious as people wish it were. And I myself actually... literally, I refused to even talk about the subject for many years. And I was talking to Swami on the phone about it one day, and I said, sir, I just don't even want to bring up the subject of intuition and guidance because I see that people just get so confused. His response, he had no sympathy for me. He said, Asha, intuition is everything. You have to help them. I said, but sir, it's just so subtle. He said, yes, so what? But what he's also saying is, yes, it's very subtle. And merely because we want to be guided doesn't mean we always are. But don't have that make you so nervous. Because a tremendous amount of superconscious intuition, honestly, it's just common sense. It's knowing what the teachings are, having studied them enough, having become honest enough and courageous enough in yourself that this is the obvious thing to do. And merely because it's weird doesn't mean it's more superconscious than it's not. And merely because it's ordinary doesn't mean it's not superconscious. It just is what it is. Someone asked Swami once, how can you tell what your dharma is, I think was actually the word. He said, his answer, well, if there's a job to do and you're next in line. That's how he put it, just as simple as that. And when we're always wondering, is this really what God wants? Is this really what God wants? Well, if it's coming to you and it's not a bad thing, take it as God's will and just go with it and see what happens. You're not necessarily going to get more clarity by becoming so obsessed within yourself about me and what I'm supposed to do. Self-forgetfulness, everything else I've said about the eight manifestations, about recognizing that God loves you and that it's fine and that whatever you do, he's going to help you through it, it kind of can take away this obsession about thinking that every little step has to be guided, because really it actually isn't. And as I've also said sometimes, God doesn't really have an opinion about most of what we do. He cares about our vibration, but he doesn't care about our actions. He doesn't care whether you fix this for dinner or go on that vacation or even marry this person or whether you have children or not. It's just a question of what consciousness you have while you're doing it. So if your prayer and your request for guidance is about consciousness, you're much more likely to get right answers. If your question is, should I do this or should I do that, and then you get answers, go ahead. There's no harm in doing that, but be humble about the possibility of your being wrong. We've all been wrong many, many, many times. And that's the only way that you learn. And so, no, you really don't know whether or not, I mean, you really can't say with certainty for a very long time whether or not you're being guided by Master, or whether you're just making it up, or whether it's semi-superconscious, semi-subconscious, semi-imagination. And I think the best way is to think about the vibrations that you're putting out and less about the specifics. And the whole issue then of guidance, of when people oppose you, it may mean that you're right and their opposition is a test. And when people oppose you, it may mean that they're right. And their opposition is God trying to speak to you. When it works out easily, it may mean that it was what God wanted you to do. And when you face nothing but obstacles, it may be because it was what God wanted you to do. You can't, there's just no rules. So you have to be very humble about it. And just say, well, I'm doing this because it seems like the right thing to do. It feels right to me, and I'm going to try it. But not, this is what God told me to do, because the very nature of guidance is it's very subtle. Just, it, you know, when the guru speaks to you, it's whispers from eternity. So as soon as you say, this is what he wants, immediately you see you've changed the whole vibration. And you've, by your egoic commitment to it, you've put yourself out of tune with it. And Swamiji, who actually said several times, he said, I can't remember a time when I was wrong. He didn't say that often. He didn't say that loudly. But he did say it on more than one occasion. I can't remember a time when I was wrong. Many times things didn't work out. But that wasn't because he was wrong. It was because they didn't work out. And usually it was because of things that happened afterwards. But he almost never, I dare say never, but almost never, said, I'm doing this because God told me to do it. And he never asserted that against other people's opposition. When they were opposed, he just listened very humbly. And when he even presented ideas that, you know, I think God delivered to him in a scroll of gold, he would say, what do you think? Because he recognized, and there wasn't an act on his part. It was that he knew that in order to stay in tune with that, he had to be very open. Because once he stopped being open, then he was automatically out of tune with it. But that didn't mean he was whimsical either. Once he felt he was supposed to do something, no power on earth could turn him away from it. That's just the way he was. If he felt he was supposed to, then he... But he didn't just assert he was supposed to do it. He put his willpower, his creativity, his determination. I mean, he put energy behind that. Merely because he felt guided, he never felt that was a guarantee. It just was his operating instructions. This is what I'm supposed to do, so I'm going to do it. But then he did it. He didn't just say it was supposed to happen. And that's a lot of times people will use guidance as a more or less a substitute for hard work. And he never did that. And that was also why his guidance remained accurate, because he never took it as a free ride or a guarantee. It was just like, well, this now I know what I'm supposed to do. And again, not everything happened yet, but that didn't mean that his response to it wasn't accurate. So I just don't think there's a yes or no answer to that. But we need to be sensible with it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's the first thing to worry about. People tend to think of it as the first thing to worry about. The first thing I need to worry about is being guided by God. Really, the first thing to worry about is to do whatever's in front of you with a vibration that will put you in tune with the Divine Spirit. And if you act in such a way with a vibration that will put you in tune with the Spirit, then you won't have to think about being guided, because you just will be. Because your heart will purify, and you'll want to do those things which are in tune. And so you'll just continually respond in a way that's in tune. And whether or not that ever comes to you in flashes of light or answers to your prayers in meditation, every once in a while, I mean, I was talking to someone, I told them something recently, and she said, why are you saying this to me? And I said, well, it's because it came into my head in that way. And that way is where it just popped in and it had a certain power to it. So now I'm going to offer it to you and see if it has any truth. I didn't say that it had truth. I just said I felt obligated. Because a lot of things pop into my head. But they don't pop into my head in that way. But after many, many years, I can tell the difference. And this does not happen to me on a daily basis by any means. But on a daily basis, I just kind of gradually figure it out. But I gradually figure it out because all the rest of the time, I'm trying to do all the things that I'm saying to you right now. You know, just like, well, this seems like the right thing. Let me try to have the right attitude. Let me try to have the right vibration. So when a decision comes, I'm not 100 miles away. And then suddenly I turn and I say, what do you want me to do? Having never really tried to live that way until I suddenly need a decision. In other words, guidance is not different from the rest of your life. There, that's what I'm trying to say. And if the rest of your life is agitated and emotional and out of control, you're not likely to be able to just suddenly ask for God's guidance and have it just bingo like that. But if the rest of your life is a constant effort to bring yourself, to make yourself receptive, then you don't even necessarily even have to ask. You just kind of, it's revealed to you on a need-to-know basis. Somebody asked me that recently, how do I make decisions? And I sort of thought for a minute and I said, I don't know. I don't think I make a lot of decisions. Really, literally, Swami made a lot of decisions for me, but he never imposed them on me, he just made them. But still, I've lived on my own. He has hardly been part of my daily life. I mean, I lived here for 30 years and I didn't see him every day or anything like that. But I was always trying to think, what would Swami do? How would Master want this? The question, how can I serve? You know, what I think Vinny, you asked that. Let me just address this before we stop. You know, why did the Masters come? and what was important to them. And you know, that's really how you serve. Why did the masters come, and what was important to them? One person said to me once, "I don't see why Master wouldn't want me to have nice things." And I thought to myself, "Why on earth would he want you to have nice things? What difference would it make to him whether you have nice things? What God wants you to be is spiritually free." Now, it may also be that having nice things is part of the karmic thing that you're unraveling, and you can feel inside yourself that I need to live at a certain level, and that this is the appropriate lifestyle for me. But it's not really that God wants you to have nice things. He doesn't care. God wants you to be spiritually free, and greater can no love be than this, to give your life for the salvation of others. So they're still engaged in this project, and they're looking for willing hands. And we, very specifically, those of us who are connected to Swamiji, good Lord, I mean, he just laid it out and initiated on 1,000 levels. Of all these different possibilities, music, art, education, meditation, philosophy, and then things that we can hardly even imagine, organic gardening, communities, temples, all of these things. So just think, how can I, one, give as much as I can to what he was trying to accomplish? And two, how can I do it in such a way that will help accomplish what he really wanted to accomplish? And it's not complicated. It all comes back exactly to the same thing. Make your dharma as much as you can, as deeply interior as possible, and practice, 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 so that when you're shifting from that, you can feel it. I don't mean to make yourself nervous, just, I'm shifting from that. You know, and that means you can go out on play dates with your friends and practice joy. It's not like you have to be serious all the time. But just make sure that you're always in one of those vibrations. Anything else before we give it up for the morning? Or is that you're glad it's over? All right. Thank you all very much. We did film, so it'll eventually, fairly soon, end up in a place where you can re-access it if you like. Nice to be home.